Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. We are here again for a schema episode. How's everyone doing today?
Can't complain. Doing great.
Well, I'm doing better since I can see Jack Penner's mustache. It is epic, full, very Tom Selleck-y. It's wonderful.
I had high hopes that the mustache was not going to be referenced on the recording, and there they go.
We had this entire conversation about how this needs to be now a visual platform because of that mustache.
Well, moving on to the case, I'm very excited that we have an awesome case for everybody today. Are we ready to get started?
Let's do it.
For the audience, just as a reminder, these schema episodes are an opportunity for us to review some of the core clinical problem solvers schemas through the lens of a clinical case. So none of us are actually blinded to the case, but we're going to be using the case as a mechanism to discuss some of the schemas, which you can find on our website. The schemas that we're going to discuss today are jaundice and lung nodules. You may remember a former schema episode in which we also examined the schema for jaundice. We are going to look at it through a different lens today, which you will see unfold in the case. And we are revisiting the jaundice schema because not only is it one of the most fun ones to think through, but it is also one of the core problems that we see in internal medicine. So get ready for jaundice round two, as well as an approach to lung nodules. And I will get us started with the first aliquot here. So this case is a 67-year-old man who presented to the emergency department with 1 week of progressive jaundice. For the last 4 to 6 weeks, he has had intermittent episodes of dull, achy abdominal pain, and often, but not always, the pain came following a meal.
All right, so let's get started. Let's first talk about jaundice. So whenever I like to think about jaundice, I like to break it into two buckets. The first being indirect, which is unconjugated bilirubin, and the second being direct, which is conjugated. Now, once I break them into these two buckets, I first like to review the life-threatening causes of each first, because there are no misdiagnoses. You don't want to forget about these, and you want to rule these out first, or at least be thinking of them first, just to make sure you're not dealing with a life-threatening cause of jaundice. And so in the indirect bucket, our life-threatening cause is going to be hemolysis. And so whenever you see an elevated indirect unconjugated bilirubin, take a quick look at the CBC and make sure you're not having an anemia, thrombocytopenia, don't need to go ahead and check a peripheral smear. After that, in the indirect bucket, some less common causes. So you can have some drugs can cause an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, a hematoma, and then some rare genetic causes, with Gilbert's being the most common. Next, let's move into our next bucket of direct conjugated elevated bilirubin. And this bucket, I like to break into two separate sections after that. So intrahepatic, so that within the liver, so your biliary tree within the liver. And this mainly involves your infiltrative diseases, a viral hepatitis, some drugs, and then cirrhosis. And then you move into your extrahepatic biliary tree, which can lead to elevated conjugated bilirubin. And for that, I like to think about three different types. So you can either have a problem in the lumen itself causing obstruction. You can have a stricture affecting the biliary tree itself and the wall, or there you can have an external cause of obstruction, something that is pressing on the outside of the biliary tree causing obstruction.
Is there anything better than learning about jaundice from the future boss lady GI fellow? That was awesome. Thanks, Lindsay. Yeah, so this patient's coming in with jaundice. And let's think a little bit about the other aspect of this case, abdominal pain, mostly what it seems like a postprandial pain that this patient is experiencing. And the fact that this kind of a background of the abdominal pain is going on for like subacutely for a while is making me a little bit worried that we're dealing with like a maybe more of a subacute nature and that this jaundice is not like acutely coming out of nowhere. So we love our Venn diagrams. So right now I'm thinking about the Venn diagram of postprandial abdominal pain and jaundice. There, first, let's just talk about postprandial pain because it's kind of cool. And then I'm going to leave the overlap to the one and only Dr. Dane Minter to talk a little bit more about. So let's focus on postprandial pain for a little bit. When I think about postprandial pain, I think basically there's a stress test for the systems that needs to help us digest food in the GI tract. So what that could be, it could be the lumen of the GI tract. It could be the vasculature that requires to bring more blood in to help us digest food. It can be the problem with the biliary tract or the pancreas. So in the lumen itself, if a patient has a peptic ulcer disease, gastroparesis, or any external compression of that lumen, it can cause pain. And sometimes with external compression, you can get early satiatry as well. Vascular one is an important one to remember because mesenteric schema falls into that category, is that if you have LR atherosclerotic disease in the vessels of the GI tract, then when you're eating and trying to digest food, you can get basically angina of the GI tract. Biliary colic and also chronic pancreatitis are the two other things to think about as well when you're thinking about postprandial pain. So think lumen, vessels, biliary tree, and pancreas. Okay, Dan, what are your thoughts about the overlap of abdominal pain and jaundice?
So when we're examining a patient who has postprandial abdominal pain and jaundice, we can look for areas in which those two symptom complexes overlap. And then by virtue of doing that, gain an added layer of specificity. So we can go crossing out the different causes of those specifics that are perhaps not in that sort of dual shaded area of the Venn diagram. So when we think about jaundice, we're thinking prehepatic, intrahepatic, posthepatic, with then posthepatic being the sort of like focus on the biliary tree. And then as Charmin mentioned, when we think about postprandial abdominal pain, then we're going to be again thinking about luminal structures of the digestive tract, vascular structures, the biliary system, and then the pancreas. So where is the element of overlap that most adequately fits this series of Venn diagrams? I'm really going to hone in on the biliary tract. So causes of postprandial biliary abdominal pain really make me think about cholecystitis, with a caveat that cholecystitis in itself doesn't tend to cause jaundice. But perhaps if a gallstone is a little bit further down into the caudal duct, or if you have something called Maritzi syndrome, where a gallstone within the neck of the cystic duct then externally compresses the common bile duct. Also with the pancreas, if you have some sort of chronic pancreatic process that is causing a stricturing of the common bile duct, that could also lead to jaundice. And we oftentimes refer to like painless jaundice in patients who have a pancreatic head mass. So, you know, that's all to say that this overlap could potentially give us, you know, sort of a leg up on advancing our diagnostic thinking in this case. It may not be true that both of these symptoms are caused by the same pathology, but if they are, then we've just advanced our thinking a little bit by at least paying more than passing tribute to diseases of the biliary system and the pancreas.
Dan, it is not too late to switch from ID to GI. Come on.
He did say Maritzi syndrome. So I feel like that is a valid point, you know? I didn't even put that in the script.
I like Dan Minter even more now than I thought I could.
Well, there's a lot of biliary pathogens, you know, those flukes and whatnot.
Oh, this is bringing me a huge smile. Let me give you the next aliquot of the case. So the patient's past medical history included hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and a recent diagnosis of diabetes 3 months prior. He took lisinopril, atorvastatin, and metformin as his medications. Review of systems included a 12-pound weight loss over the last 6 months, a chronic cough that had developed over a similar time frame, as well as progressive exertional dyspnea. He had a 12-pack year smoking history and had quit about 30 years prior. He consumed 1 to 2 alcoholic beverages per week and lived in the Central Valley of Northern California. On exam, he was afebrile with stable vital signs. Exam was notable for icteric sclera and jaundiced skin. He had mild epigastric tenderness to palpation, and there were no stigmata of portal hypertension or hyperestrogenism. He also had no bruises. Labs were notable for an anemia to 10.2. This is a drop from a normal hemoglobin 1 year prior, as well as an AST of 25, an ALT of 33, an ALK-FOS of 328, and a T-bili of 5.8. which was fractionated to reveal a D-bili of 3.6. A chest x-ray demonstrated scattered nodular opacities throughout the bilateral lung fields.
Well, since Lindsay is going to be our resident GI fellow pretty soon, maybe I'll leave the discussion of jaundice to her, and I'll kind of focus on some of the other features of this case that have come out, including the weight loss and the pulmonary symptoms. So, you know, basically at this point, we've taken what was something of a more isolated case of jaundice and now are expanding our thought process based on these other symptoms. Weight loss, you know, the way I think about that is I'm a simple person. So I think, you know, you're not getting enough calories in or you're using too many calories. And if you're not getting enough calories in, maybe it's that you're not eating or you're not absorbing. And then if you have too many calories out, it's either, you know, something inflammatory, like an infection, some other inflammatory disease, or potentially a malignancy. So, you know, that's all to say that, you know, now that we have this degree of relatively well-documented weight loss over the past 6 months, that raises my level of concern for some serious systemic process. And then also makes me sort of think about, you know, is it a calories in or a calories out problem? And I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit more in the case as it comes up. What to do with the lung findings? So this patient not only is experiencing jaundice, but they're also experiencing some cough and shortness of breath and some sort of symptom complexes that refer us to the lung. So, you know, that serves one sort of major helpful action in this case is to move us away from the biliary system as we were sort of beginning to focus in on a little bit more and wonder if this is some process that is, you know, systemic and is truly having sort of a primary focus within the thorax as well as within the abdomen, or, you know, if we're going to draw our sort of causal arrows, is something in the abdomen the primary process causing pulmonary findings or the other way around? The objective data that we have at this point is that the chest x-ray demonstrates quote-unquote scattered nodular opacities in the bilateral lung fields. So that adds a degree of specificity. This is something that we can't ignore at this point and makes me more and more worried about some intrathoracic process. So what are these opacities? As a general rule, pulmonary opacities could be something that's within the alveolar space. That could be pus, water, blood. It could be something within the interstitium, or it could be a sort of tissue-based mass. So if these are pulmonary metastases or primary pulmonary cancer or something like that. Just because I can't help myself, one thing I'll say is that, you know, for those of you who don't practice in Arizona or California, the Central Valley is a buzzword for us for coccidioidomycosis, which is a dimorphic fungal pathogen that we think a lot about here in California. So I'm not sure if that's going to be related to this case. I would, you know, be jumping up and down if it was, but I'm holding my excitement.
Awesome. Now, as Dan said, I'm going to try to focus on some of the liver lab just as to refresh. So your AST was 25, ALT is 33, ALT FOS 328, a T-Billy 5.8 with a D-Billy of 3.6. So how does that help us make progress in our case? So whenever I'm looking at liver labs, I'm trying to characterize them as cholestatic or hepatocellular. And cholestatic liver picture will show an elevated ALT FOS and an elevated direct bilirubin, whereas a hepatocellular liver injury will show more of an elevated AST and ALT out of proportion to the other two. And so with this patient's lab specifically, you're seeing that really elevated ALT FOS and D-Billy, which is out of proportion to the normal AST, ALT. And so that puts us in the bucket of cholestatic liver injury. And so then when I think about cholestatic liver injury, I'm thinking about the biliary tree or something either internally in the biliary tree or something externally pressing on the biliary tree causing obstruction. Now that can be from the gallbladder, it can be from the small intestine, it can be from lymph nodes, it can be from the pancreatic head. So anything around that area that can cause obstruction can cause this picture. And, you know, what diagnostic step is next, whenever you are thinking about a cholestatic liver injury, there are so many imaging modalities that you can choose to try to investigate this. And so you have an ultrasound, a CT with contrast, an MRI or MRCP that looks specifically at the biliary tree, or you can go straight to GI and ask them for an ERCP or an EUS. An ERCP is endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography. Say it three times fast.
I never try to say that. It's mostly because I don't know what it stands for.
And then an EUS is an endoscopic ultrasound. And so basically go in with an endoscope and ultrasound the area that you're concerned about. And so really, when you're trying to decide between any of those imaging modalities, you're trying to figure out how urgent you need your image, the availability of the imaging modality, and if there's anything else that the patient may have that you want to investigate that may make you want to pick one imaging study over the other. And so ultrasound is really great for the biliary tree if you're just wanting to look at the biliary tree to see if there's any biliary dilation. A CT is great if you're wanting to look at maybe something else. So this patient has pulmonary nodules, they have biliary involvement. So if you're wanting to give this patient one study that may capture both, that may be better. An MRCP specifically looks at just the biliary tree, and it's actually better at picking up PSC and stuff that may be not a stone. And then, of course, if you're concerned about cholangitis, you may want to just go ahead and call GI for that ERCP. So since this patient also has pulmonary findings, you may consider just going ahead and doing one study so you can try to capture both. And if you're not able to find the biliary findings on that CT, an ultrasound or MRCP can be more sensitive.
Absolutely awesome discussion, team. As requested by Dr. Shipley, CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis revealed multiple randomly distributed pulmonary nodules, some of which had central cavitation. The abdominal and pelvic portions of the CT scan showed dilation of the common bile duct up to 1.5 centimeters and no discrete stones, masses, or lymphadenopathy.
All right. Who am I to get in the way of pulmonary nodules on an ID fellow? So I'll leave that up to Dan and then focus, with Lindsay's permission, under the common bile duct dilation, which kind of makes me think about the extrahepatic etiologies of the jaundice that Lindsay laid out for us in the beginning of the case. So pulling up our extrahepatic biliary obstruction schema, but the question that I'm asking myself is, what could happen inside the lumen of that bile duct, the wall of the bile duct, or the external environment that the bile duct sits in? What could happen that will cause obstruction and leading to jaundice? In terms of the lumen, you know, we can think about stone, sludge, biliary cast, and I have to say parasites because of Dan. What can happen within the walls? And what of the wall pathology usually leads to strictures, cancers in the form of cholangiocarcinoma, trauma, ischemic injury, and autoimmune diseases such as primary sclerosing cholangitis. And are we really CP solvers if I don't mention IgG4 disease? Yep, IgG4 disease can do it too. There are more rare causes of strictures, such as infectious processes like acholangiopathy and infiltrative processes such as mastocytosis, amyloid, but quite rare. So I would always like to focus my cognitive energy in the most common causes. Lastly, the external compression. So thinking about the environment that the common bile duct, this floppy tube, sits in. So cancers of the pancreas, ampullary of water, and duodenal pathologies and cancers can lead to external compression. And so those really big lymph nodes that can surround that biliary duct.
Awesome, Charmaine. Thank you so much for walking us through that. And now that we have this comprehensive understanding of what potential processes can cause an extrahepatic biliary obstruction, to move our own reasoning process forward, we can start to think about how we take this list of potential etiologies and prioritize them in terms of what is more and less likely. And so if we think about rooting ourselves in the epidemiology of the causes of extrahepatic biliary obstruction, far and away, the most common underlying etiology is going to be gallstone disease. Often, but not always, we'll be able to see gallstone disease on the CT scan. And so the absence of this finding here, while it certainly doesn't rule out that there is potentially a stone obstructing the common bile duct, it makes us start to expand our differential diagnosis to include some of the other disease mechanisms that Charmaine mentioned. If we go back to the reasoning that Dan and Lindsay and Charmaine shared with us earlier in the case, we can start to see an underlying process such as malignancy rising higher and higher, right? We have multiple foci of disease in multiple organs of the body. We have a subacute syndrome of systemic inflammation in somebody who is a bit elderly. And so we can see malignancy starting to work its way up the case. But, right, if we're going to actually test this hypothesis, what we're going to need in the absence of a definitive understanding of the etiology of the obstruction on CT scan is to get a look inside and around the biliary tree. And this is where the assistance of our GI colleagues or the hepatobiliary team can be quite helpful, because they have the skills necessary to perform an ERCP. What an ERCP can help us do in this case is be not only diagnostic, but also therapeutic. The ERCP can give us a look at the biliary tree. Do we see a stone there that the CT scan didn't pick up? Or do we see another explanation for the extrahepatic biliary obstruction? And then the ERCP also gives us an opportunity to deploy a therapeutic intervention to relieve the obstruction in and of itself. So it's an incredibly effective, both diagnostic and therapeutic intervention that we can potentially get in one fell swoop. Other things that we can do during an ERCP procedure would be to take more diagnostic sampling, for example, tissues or acquiring the stone if we wanted to send it off for further analysis.
Beautiful, Jack. I kind of think that your discussion of the epidemiology was put in there in part to just dissuade me from thinking about liver flukes and all the other wonderful parasites that we could get.
It was not a fluke.
I'm dying on the inside. Okay. Well, yeah. Charmaine wanted me to talk about pulmonary nodules as the other part of this case, which is really interesting based on the CT scan. So if you're near a computer, I'd suggest that you go to the CP Solvers website and look at the lung nodule schema. Basically, there are three main buckets of diffuse pulmonary nodules. This is in contrast to like the solitary pulmonary nodule that you might see in another context. So this is if you have multiple sort of small pulmonary nodules throughout the lungs. And these are all in reference to the pulmonary lobule, which is the smallest divisible component of the lung parenchyma. And so what that really is it's a sort of unit of lung parenchyma that's surrounded by lymphatics, almost in like a hexagonal sort of structure, into which run a main airway, or into which run an airway and then a blood vessel. These are also covered with sort of capillaries, so there is blood flow throughout the entirety of the pulmonary lobule. So with respect to the pulmonary lobule, there are centrolobular, randomly distributed, and perilymphatic forms of nodules. Let's start with centrolobular nodules. These are nodules that are in the center of the pulmonary lobule. And how do you get to the center of the pulmonary lobule? The most common way is through the airway. So these tend to be airway-centric diseases. As an infectious diseases fellow, this is, you know, kind of what we tend to see most of the time is centrolobular nodules more reflective of airway spread of infection. The infections that you can see can be viral, bacterial, mycobacterial, or fungal. There are also non-infectious causes like aspiration or hypersensitivity pneumonitis, or even the spread of an endobronchial tumor. But one tip off for centrolobular nodules is if you look at the part of the lung abutting the pleura, is there shouldn't be any nodules actually touching the pleural space. If we move on to randomly distributed nodules, these are nodules that have no relationship to the pulmonary lobule. And how do you get random distribution of things? It's wherever blood goes, a nodule might show up. So these are things that tend to be transmitted by the blood, like hematogenous infections, like miliary TB or miliary fungal infection, or potentially the transmission of a hematogenous malignancy. So you get metastatic disease that's just sort of randomly distributed throughout the lung parenchyma. So this would be a relatively good sort of picture for somebody who has hematogenous distribution of solid tumor metastases. The last major category, like I said, is perilymphatic nodules. And these, if you think about like the sort of hexagonal-ish pentagonal structure of the pulmonary lobule, these are around the edges of that where the lymphatics really serve to drain the lymph from the pulmonary system. So these can occur most commonly in inflammatory diseases like sarcoidosis or pneumoconiosis like silicosis. Or you can also see them in malignant diseases like lymphangitic carcinomatosis, where you just really have kind of a buildup of stuff around the outside of the pulmonary lobule. So again, to summarize, centrolobular, randomly distributed, or perilymphatic, centrolobular being airway, randomly distributed being more through just kind of hematogenous system dissemination, and then perilymphatic really sort of focusing in on those lymphatic channels around the outside of the pulmonary lobule.
Boom.
Boom, indeed.
All right. So given what Dan has told us about pulmonary nodules, it seems like the distribution of the nodules for this patient are random. And so that makes us fall into that bucket of hematogenous spread. And whenever we think about hematogenous spread, exactly what Dan was saying, we're prioritizing malignancy, especially in this patient who is having weight loss and postprandial pain, cholestatic picture, liver injury. And so I think making sure we're not dealing with an infection and making sure we're not dealing with two different things, but also realizing that given that this is a random distribution with hematogenous spread, that this could definitely be a malignancy coming from somewhere in the biliary tree.
So to give you all the conclusion of this case, after this excellent discussion, blood cultures, coccidioides, immunodiffusion, and complement fixation were both negative. Patient also underwent sputum testing and an AFB smear culture and MTB PCR were also all negative. Patient ultimately underwent ERCP and endoscopic ultrasound, which demonstrated a 4-centimeter pancreatic head mass and a distal bile duct stricture. A biliary stent was placed and biopsies of the mass were taken. Biopsies of both the pancreatic head mass and of one of the lung nodules revealed pancreatic adenocarcinoma, and the patient was discharged home with plans to follow up with oncology for initiation of systemic chemotherapy. And just to clarify here, the reason that one of the lung nodules was biopsied is because it's quite atypical for pancreatic cancer to potentially go to the lungs, particularly if there are no liver lesions present as well. And the fact that these lesions were cavitating also, I learned, was atypical of a pancreatic adenocarcinoma. And so there was some diagnostic uncertainty over whether if we found what was the underlying etiology of the extrahepatic biliary obstruction, whether or not it would definitively explain the pulmonary nodules in this case. For those of you who are wondering, why did they take 2 biopsies? So team, would love to hear your reflections on this case or any other thoughts overall on the topics that we covered today. I will say the last that I heard that this patient is overall doing well, despite what is a very, very sad and very sobering diagnosis overall.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing, Jack. And, you know, I love talking about like jaundice in abstract. And I think a lot of patients that we take care of, unfortunately, I don't like it in real life as much because it turns into usually often like these really terrible pancreatic cancer diagnoses that comes with it a lot of like suffering and poor prognosis. It's still important to talk about, to learn from, and to reflect on. And did the abdominal pain get better, Jack, by the way?
Fortunately, it didn't change much after the biliary obstruction was intervened upon.
Yeah. And that's another reason to kind of like circle back to our Venn diagram is that our job is not done yet. I think it's also easy to contribute the abdominal pain to this terrible cancer and also making sure that there's no other etiology that we can help this patient with.
Yeah, 100%. Couldn't have said it better. And there are some patients, if they have, you know, pancreas, if we do find that the pancreatic cancer is causing a lot of the pain, they can go back and do a celiac plexus block for these patients, which helps a lot. It's more of a palliative procedure, but it can help tremendously with pain in that area.
That's such a great point, Lindsay. And one of the reasons I love being a doctor, because our job is never done. There's so many tools that we have, whether it's, you know, a diagnosis, treatment, or palliative, you know, at the end of the day, it's all done in the service to make sure patients have a good quality of life and be able to help them, whether it's with pain or getting answers. So, you know, we got a pretty awesome job.
One of my reflections is it's so much fun to learn from everybody's sort of specific area of interest, and Lindsay and Charmaine, you know, just amazing pearls and stuff. So really, really appreciated learning from both of you on this case. And thanks, Jack, again for presenting and rocking that mustache.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you all for joining us today for another installment of our Schema episode series. We hope you have a great rest of the day, and thanks again for tuning in.
That's a wrap, folks.